Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. As editor of the New York Times Modern Love column since 2004, Daniel Jones has read well over 50,000 love letters. Well, not love letters exactly, but essays about love. And most of them were actually emails rather than letters, which says a lot about the state of romance in 2014, given how much of it sparks, burns, and is often extinguished all on a computer screen. Technology's impact on modern love features heavily in Daniel Jones's new book, Love Illuminated, exploring life's most mystifying subjects with the help of 50,000 strangers. And Daniel Jones, we welcome you to Word of Mouth. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
9 years into editing this column, are you an expert on love?
I'm more educated than I was before, or at least that's my wife's hope, I think.
But you're not yet a love mensa?
You know, it's a little hard to make that claim. This is a subject that's been written about and studied so much. I feel like I'm more, as I say in the beginning of the book, I don't feel like I've been mastering love all these years as much as marinating in it. And I feel more like a pickle in a jar than a guru on a mountaintop.
You write about all different aspects of love. One, just to narrow it down, we can focus on technology. And if you had to guess, which percentage of submissions to the Modern Love column have to do with technology in some way, whether it would be online dating or online relationships or how we communicate with devices, any of those things?
Yeah, I mean, probably as a focus, I'd say a third of them, you know, involve technology. But in terms of having technology and communication devices and those sorts of things as parts of the story, I mean, it's got to be 80 or 90%.
Online dating was pretty well established when Modern Love, the column, was created in 2004. I'm wondering if we think even in the past 10 years, online dating has changed the nature of relationships.
Well, from what I can tell, it has. It changes our mindset going into relationships because some people are very clear-headed about who they think they would be compatible with. I'm not sure if that turns out to be right for them, but they at least go in with that feeling, and they would have before online dating. But online dating forces anyone who participates in it to try to figure out in advance, according to sort of parameters and income and height and all those sorts of common and uncommon questions the sites ask you to figure out in advance. And often we just rule out whole groups of people based on who we think is most like us or who isn't.
So you and your wife tried a kind of experiment. You both signed up on a dating site to see if it would identify you as potential matches for each other. So what happened?
We actually signed up on two online dating sites, and to say why we were in midlife and looking, my wife said that I had died and her husband had died, and I had said that I was divorced, and otherwise we answered all the questions truthfully. And we waited for our own profile to roll in and be reintroduced because we're really incredibly compatible in so many ways and have so much in common, and we were even born 10 days apart and 10 miles apart in the same state. Neither site, no matter how long we were on them, no matter how many profiles were delivered to us with these smiling faces, it was never either of us. So apparently we shouldn't be together.
Well, you know, you say you tell the truth. She actually lied a little.
Well, we only lied about that. One thing that made us, it turned out, incompatible is, and this has been a longstanding gripe, is that she had put her preferred income level for her husband to be higher than I'd confessed to in my profile. So I guess based on that basis alone, you know, I'd been ruled out early.
You give an example of this woman named Sophia who never would have met her partner had she chosen it online. Can you tell us a little bit about their story?
Yes, I can. And their story, which I'll mention in a moment, is so common where you don't know who you're going to love. In her case, she was a Berkeley war protesting hippie of sort of the highest level, criticizing corporate America and the military and all of that. Anyway, she had a mutual friend who thought that she might like, you know, this friend of his. and that they should go out. And unbeknownst to her, he was a ROTC soldier cop who liked to collect guns and read ammo magazine and all of that, and was as conservative can be. And she liked him, and she liked the way he treated her. And she fought against this relationship for months and I think even years before she finally broke down and thought, well, I love him and he loves me. And, you know, they're still together all these years later. She would have ruled him out 20 different ways before meeting him if she'd seen him in a profile.
Well, it is really easy to start a relationship online, and you have a segment there called Soulmate in a Box about people who connect exclusively through emails and texts and Skype. Some have never, ever met. Have you come to understand the appeal of that kind of a relationship?
Oh, I completely understand the appeal of it. And it's the appeal of starting a relationship without having to feel vulnerable. And that's always what the big stumbling block is. We don't want to feel vulnerable, and we don't want to feel like we can be rejected. And stumbling into an online relationship with someone has a real insulating quality. You don't feel like it can be possible because they're far away, and it's impractical to get together. And this allows the people to, you know, because they're only communicating by talking, they completely let down their guard. They completely open up their heart, and they get really deep really fast. But it's not a full relationship. You can have emotional and intellectual chemistry, and then you can have physical chemistry, and you can try to separate those two. But if you want to have a real full relationship, they all have to be together.
There's a story that you retell about Caitlin. She's a college student with that idea that she's perfectly in control until something sort of tips over. What happens with her?
Yeah, she had met this guy who lives 900 miles away or something. They were both in college. And they'd met at some conference just briefly in a bar and then connected via Twitter later. And their connection snowballed into one of these what I call soulmate in a box relationships, where you can get all your emotional sustenance through Skype and by confessing everything to them because you don't think it's ever really going to turn real. But then it becomes so strong that you have to take that chance of meeting in person and making it real. So she travels finally. She rents a car and travels 9 hours or however long it takes her to go see him. And in person, it's not the same thing, in part because they're uncomfortable physically in person, in part because he was used to getting his emotional fix online. And so when they were together in the same room, he was still lured toward his iPhone and lured toward his laptop because that's where it had come from before, and it's just a hard habit to break.
That, I guess, is a common theme in many of these stories that you retell in your book, Love Illuminated. The idea that even if you find somebody, there are just no guarantees. Or as you write, you have no answers to provide. It's the questions that count. What do you mean by that?
I don't think in relationships telling someone what to do is all that helpful. I think you can tell them what other people do and what has happened and what patterns people fall into, and then they can figure their way out of it. There's nothing more impossible than trying to convince somebody not to love somebody that you think is wrong for them. I feel like the most useful advice, or non-advice, for people in relationships is to give them examples of what other people have done and hope that helps.
Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column of the New York Times. His new book is called Love Illuminated, exploring life's most mystifying subject with the help of 50,000 strangers. Thank you so much for sharing some stories today.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
You can find much more on Daniel's book. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
I belong to your heart. You alone can possess me. No one else can caress me. I belong to your heart. I belong to your heart.
With devotion. From mammoth ice structures to snowshoe racers, NHPR reporter Sean Hurley finds the humanity in some of the chilliest corners of the North Country. Today he brings us a story that begins, as so many good stories do, with a chance encounter.
I love moats. I always have. I never made sandcastles at the beach. Just moats. If I saw a kid dripping sand over a turdy structure, I'd say, hey, that thing needs a moat, am I right? Like a used moat salesman, I'd drop to my knees and start moating away. When I visited Lance Keene last year at the castle he's been building for almost a decade on a cliff in Thornton, moats were on my mind.
Will there be a moat?
You know what? People always ask that. Is there going to be a moat? Do you think I could put a moat? I'm on a cliff. I'm on the side of a cliff.
And dungeon?
Oh, I love dungeons, too. The old wisecracking skinny guy in the caveman t-shirt with his stick arms and the shackles.
Dungeon would be nice, but we'd have to blast.
Yeah. So no moat, no dungeon, no castle even. Not yet. Though Lance has built a huge grand terrace, stone by stone, 116 feet long and 14 feet high, he's been prevented from bringing the building crews up because there's no road to the top of his mountain. Road contractors told him that carving a driveway up this steep wild mountain would cost $100,000. So Lance did what he always does. He bought an excavator and just started excavating.
I really thought this road would be done in about 3 months, and it took me a year and a half.
Lance's love of castles began when he was in the army. Stationed in Germany, he and his friends would tour castles on the weekends. But as it turned out,
one of my favorite castles in the world is here in New Hampshire. It's in Windham, New Hampshire, Searle's Castle.
The yet-to-be-built Keene Castle is modeled after Searle's Castle, which took 10 years to build and was finished in 1915. And while Lance has visited Searle's countless times,
I've never been inside.
Only sort of lurked.
Yes, I want to respect their privacy and not just go walking around the grounds uninvited. So I would just drive around and peek in through the gate.
Lance told me sadly that Searle's wasn't really open to the public. You could rent it out for weddings or private functions, but public tours just didn't happen. But then, once upon a time, a few weeks ago,
there was one day, it was a Sunday afternoon, we just went out driving, and sometimes we'll just go driving in some random direction. We found ourselves driving up towards Lincoln.
Lance and his family walked along the river, but soon found themselves getting cold. They decided to stop in at the Common Man for hot chocolate.
Went up to pay and started a conversation with the man at the bar.
The man at the bar was David Colefrath.
So he came up and, you know, being gregarious people that we both are, we talked to each other.
And he asked me where I was from, and I said, well, I live down in Waterville Estates in Camden. So, but the house that we're in now is just temporary until we get our other house built. We're building a medieval stone castle in Thornton.
I said, so what kind of a castle are you building? He said, well, I'm kind of copying this place down in Windham. You know, it's Searle's Castle.
And I pull out this one picture of the 3D CAD drawing that I'd done, and he said, wow, that's an interesting design.
And my wife's sitting next to me, and she goes, that's our castle.
What do you mean that's your castle? I said, that's our castle. We own Searle's Castle. No kidding. You've got to be kidding.
The King of Keene Castle had just met the King of Searle's Castle. The two gregarious kings decided, as kings do, to visit each other's castles. So this past Saturday morning, Lance and his family drove to Windham for a tour. Colefrath met us at the door with his gold top cane.
This is Sean.
Show it up. How are you doing, Sean? Dave Colefrath.
Lance Keene's eyes glow and his mouth hangs open as he simply beholds. After Colefrath welcomes us to Searle's Castle, Lance says he hopes to one day welcome Colefrath to Keene Castle. Colefrath nods with ironic approval.
It's so humble of you to have not, like, taken advantage and named it after yourself like that.
This is well, Searle's did the same thing, didn't he?
Oh, so now you're Edward Searle's.
And thus began the playful kingly banter. Edward Searle's, Colefrath tells us, was primarily an interior decorator. He grew up poor, and after marrying one of the wealthiest women in America, began building castles and structures whose interiors he could decorate. He traveled around Europe with his wife, collecting unusual pieces.
For example, these doors are actually from Windsor Castle. He found out that they were redoing the servants' entrance, these doors were going to be replaced with something more modern.
Standing before a granite fireplace that used to be in Napoleon's castle, Colefrath begins to falter.
If you could see, there's a backplate in here. I used to have a flashlight. I had trouble thinking of the word dog the other day. I asked my wife, did you let the furry thing with the legs?
With a little pushing, he explains.
I have to apologize. I got a little bit of chemo brain. I've been through chemotherapy just recently. It affects my long-term and short-term memory. I've stage 4 pancreatic cancer, so I'm on the way out. They're trying to delay it. Let's put it that way.
We travel through the castle. The music room with its polished black piano, the various parlors and sitting rooms. When Colefrath leaves us for a moment, Lance sits at the piano in the music room near Napoleon's fireplace.
Are you a piano player?
Well, he used to be. Well, I haven't touched a piano in about 6 or 7 years. Jeez.
After the tour, the two men make plans to meet at Keene Castle. And Colefrath reveals that he's just bought a home in Waterville Estates, about a half mile from where Lance lives. It's high up on the mountain and faces the valley. Photos are brought out of the new place, but Lance knows exactly where it is.
You can actually see my property from yours.
Really?
So if you look right over here, there's a mountain right here.
Yeah.
Big hill. We own the top of that.
Uh-huh.
So even as he suspects, David's illness will likely prevent him from visiting Lance's castle in progress on the cliff. He will be able to watch the castle rise majestically in the air, their kingdoms overlapping then, the end of one reign and the beginning of another. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
There's more Word of Mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, we threw out the challenge and you delivered in a big way. We asked which is better, songs about being in love or being heartbroken, and which are the best examples of songs in each genre. Later, we'll reveal the results of our totally subjective listener poll. But first, a little more scientific. What makes for a chart-topping hit? Love or heartbreak? Joining me now is a man with some stats. Joe Levy is editorial director of Billboard. He's former editor-in-chief of Blender magazine and was executive editor of Rolling Stone for 10 years. So certainly knows the business. Joe Levy, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good to be here.
Music is so subjective. Billboard is all about the numbers. So looking at the current Billboard chart, would you say songs about heartbreak or love are more popular at this moment?
Well, right now, as we're talking, love is in the lead. Love is slightly in the lead, but love is in the lead on this week's Billboard Hot 100.
Well, I'm a love advocate, so that's good.
Well, okay. I am a lover, not a fighter, so I will not get into it with you on that right now. I will say we've got two very different kind of love songs in the 1 and 2 spot. Katy Perry's Dark Horse, which is a sort of, do you want to be in love with me? Make up your mind because I will do fantastic, magical things with you. And Beyonce's Drunk in Love, which I think also involves fantastic, magical things. Love as an inebriatory experience. And that's the 1 and 2 songs in the country right now. At number 6 is the most heartbroken song I can think of in recent memory, and that's Passengers' Let Her Go, which is about all sorts of disappointments in life, but principally about romantic disappointment.
Yeah, and it picks up on that you never miss your water until your well runs dry kind of old trope that we've been hearing in love songs or not in love songs for a long time.
Yeah, I think that one goes back to the Madrigals, although I'm not an authority on medieval music.
You only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go.
Historically speaking, do love songs or songs about heartache tend to be the chart toppers?
Well, they're both chart toppers. The love songs are a little bit in the lead. Billboard.com is putting out Valentine's Day lists of both love songs and breakup songs, and you know, songs like "Endless Love." It's a classic, 1981, number one for 9 weeks. "I'll Make Love to You" by Boys to Men, number one for 14 weeks in 1984. But the breakup songs like "Unbreak My Heart," "We Belong Together" by Mariah Carey, those are just as strong when it comes to topping the charts.
Billboard has a number of different charts as a pop, country, rock, R&B. Do love and heartache make for good material across genres?
Oh, yeah. I think it certainly does. I think that the subject is a universal. I will say, when you think about heartbreak, you think about country.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about love songs, I think that you tend to, at least if you're me, think about smooth R&B.
Yeah.
And maybe Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye, Whitney Houston, "I Will Always Love You," number one for 14 weeks. In these chart toppers, there are a few rock songs, but we're really talking about, say, Wings singing "Silly Little Love Songs" in 1976 and topping the charts for 5 weeks. Otherwise, this is a list dominated by R&B.
Okay, we understand why people love love songs, but why do you think they're so enamored of songs about heartbreak? I mean, do we love to wallow in our misery?
It's not quite the way it feels to me. I like to know that there's somebody else who felt the same way. When I hit that moment, I love to hear that song that says it all for me. So, I don't know, maybe I don't have to bore my friends by saying it all again.
Is there one that says it all for you, the heartbreak song?
I guess there are two that I've turned to in my moments of heartbreak. There's a classic New Orleans R&B song by Irma Thomas called "It's Raining."
Oh,
it's one
beauty.
Of the most heartbroken songs in existence. And I have been known to, going way, way back when you had needles on turntables, I have been known to move the tone arm back on that one, 10 or 15 times in a row.
It's raining so hard.
How about for the love song, where have you dropped the tone arm when you're in those first beautiful throes of love?
I like a Smokey Robinson song called "Cruisin'," which is about driving around, listening to the radio and, getting involved in other amorous situations, perhaps in the car. I just think it's one of the sexiest songs out there. And then I'm a big fan of Madonna's "Crazy for You," because I'm a big Madonna fan in general, and that song is awesome.
Is that I'm crazy for you?
Joe Levy, thank you so much for weighing in today.
Oh, good to be here.
Joe Levy, editorial director for Billboard.
It's all brand new. You'll feel it in my kiss. I'm crazy for you.
Well, you waited patiently, and the results are in. What makes for a better song, love or heartbreak? We asked you for your favorites in either category. Then we counted those votes and whittled them down to two finalists. Now we are ready to announce which one of those wins, the lovers or the criers. But first, a brief moment to introduce our finalists. Representing for love songs, Etta James, "At Last."
At last.
And fighting for heartbreak is Bill Withers' "Ain't No Sunshine." Interestingly enough, his song "Just the Two of Us" was a brief contender for Best Love Song, but I digress.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone.
And now the winner is
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. Only darkness every day. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's his house just ain't.
Thank you to everyone who voted in our entirely unscientific poll. You can take a look at how we whittled down the winners on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And thank you for proving out another lyric from a very old song, that falling in love is just the first stage of the blues.
Anytime she goes away.
Love songs are ripe for parody, from virtually anything by Celine Dion to Whitney Houston's melodramatic classic, I Will Always Love You. They tend toward the smarmy and simplistic, or the soaring and saccharine, and depending on the love life status of the listener, are either adored or reviled. Word of Mouth thought it would be fun to compose a love song using only chart-topping lyrical clichés. So we asked for your suggestions and then sent our creative team into the studio to brainstorm.
All right. So the question I was sort of going with is, like, how over the top should it be?
100% over the top.
I think it should be super over the top.
Walking in the rain, wet rain, wet rain.
I think you gotta go more over the top.
I don't. I mean, you know, this is all I got.
Mi corazón, mi amor, besos, besos, muchos besos.
When you walked into that room that first time.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate the help.
Yesterday, producer Taylor Quimby, whose musical talents we were relying on for this love song challenge, admitted he was having a little trouble.
Okay, so you all know that I've been working on the love song. It's due tomorrow. I don't think it's going well.
What's wrong?
It's just really hard to do this love song for so many reasons, I think. But one of them is probably we don't have the right talent. So I'm going to take the blame on this one and say that, you know, I mean, I think...
Well, wait. In fairness, it was not in your job description that you were expected to churn out a great love song. So Taylor played where he'd gotten to so far and asked for some advice on what to do next. We'll pick it up in there. Okay, so I hear the plaintive bit. You know, there's a kind of sweetness there. I like the little falsetto. I like doing all of the cliched kind of titles.
Right.
But there was a part of me that just sort of thought that, you know, you need to have strings. You need to have
right.
beat.
Well, production is a huge part of the love song. Right? Yeah.
It doesn't sound like a joke. I think you need to take it much further, much earlier.
In general, they're totally over the top. They're, right. you know... I will always love you. I mean, there are endless love. I mean, that's why the histrionics of a Celine Dion or a Mariah Carey make it work.
Right.
Because you, for a couple of minutes, buy into that. You are too authentic a person.
Let's just scrap the
it
whole.
It was too genuine. To make the thing work, I think.
Maybe we need a new lead singer.
Sorry, Taylor.
Well, you're out of the band, Taylor.
So maybe the solution here is that, you know, we put the chords online and the words, and we open this challenge up to maybe somebody who's got the chops that I don't.
My husband's musician.
Okay, so we're officially going to throw this out. Thank you, Taylor, for all of your work in getting it to this stage.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And we're going to throw out the chords, the rather dumb lyrics... Put that on the internets and invite anybody who wants to pick up this challenge to create a, you know, heart throbbing in the chest kind of love song.
Okay. Well, in that case, then let's play them what they're working with. So here's what we got so far.
You walked into the room. You walked into the club. You walked out of the rain. Wet, wet rain.
You looked at me, and I looked at you, and our eyes locked, and I looked away. Then I looked back at your eyes, looking back at my eyes. I looked at your eyes, and I knew what I want to say. Set me free, be with me by my side. All we've been through, wrap my arms, hold me close. Moments like this, my heart beats for all time. When you walked into the room, and when my dreams come true. And when we first met, first kiss, first touch like this, baby.
Baby.
Baby. Baby,
baby.
Baby, baby. Baby, baby. Nothing compares, nobody else. Hit me with your best shot. I'm crazy in love. And this is the part of the song that I sing in falsetto. And this is the part of the song where I suddenly stop before the beat drops. Two lovers in love, making lovely love like lovers do. True love, pure love, do or say or change anything for you.
You can listen back to the seeds of the ultimate cliched love song and find lyrics and chords at wordofmouthradio.org. And please, we need your help to make this song work. For the sake of all that we love, we can't go on without you. Make your own cover or interpretation and share it with us via YouTube or SoundCloud. You can post the link on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. All contenders will be considered and pretty much guaranteed some airtime. Up next on Word of Mouth, the surprising story of the Presbyterian minister who invented the graham cracker and why he would be aghast at its sinfully sweet modern version. Stay with us for that story and more Word of Mouth after the break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sylvester Graham would have hated the s'more. The inventor of the graham cracker was no ordinary food entrepreneur. He was the fervent leader of one of America's first big diet trends. Only Graham's strict regimen of bland foods was not about losing weight or lowering cholesterol. The graham cracker was part of a health movement designed to squelch America's sexual urges. Here to tell us more about this forgotten bit of food history is Adi Braun, who wrote about Sylvester Graham for The Atlantic. Hello, Adi.
Hi, Virginia.
So tell us more about Sylvester Graham and what led him to prominence as a 19th century health guru.
Yeah, so Sylvester Graham was an evangelical reverend in America during the first half of the 19th century in the Northeast. He came out of these social and health reform movements that were gaining popularity at the time. So the temperance movement, the early feminists, the abolitionists, this was pre-Civil War America, the people promoting kind of alternative health and lifestyles, like anti-tobaccoists, anti-caffeine. He came out of this, and he really made a name for himself initially by giving these very fiery speeches to young men, warning them against the dangers of masturbation. So Graham believed that the more exciting and therefore the more immoral the sexual act, the worse it was for your health. So he had this kind of sliding scale of sexual depravity. On the one end, you had marital sex, which was the most innocuous, and that was okay, but only once a month, because beyond that was excessive and pathological. And on the other hand, you had self-stimulation, which was, in Graham's mind, the most exciting and therefore the most harmful. And in fact, he blamed the cholera epidemic of 1832 in part to these excessive sexual behaviors. You know, he saw gluttony as part of this commercialization, you know, materialism. And so out of these ideas about reigning in excess and repressing people's sexual urges, he formulated a comprehensive lifestyle plan, which he called the Graham System of Living. At the heart of this system was the Graham diet. It prohibited the drinking of alcohol, you know, no tobacco, no caffeine, no spices. That was too exciting for him, and no meat. Graham was one of the fathers of the early American vegetarian movement. And the diet really consisted of fruits, vegetables, a little bit of dairy, and whole wheat. And whole wheat became increasingly important to Graham.
Among those staples that he took issue with was white bread. What was his opposition?
Yeah, so white bread was really a problem for Graham. What was happening at the time was the era of early industrialization, and with it came the beginnings of the commercial food industry. And all of these additives were being put into the white bread, copper, alum, clay, chalk, all these things to make it whiter and also to extend its shelf life. You know, Graham may have been exaggerating the health crisis a bit, so much so, in fact, that he wrote an entire a book about how to make homemade bread out of whole wheat flour. And whole wheat flour, Graham was convinced, would restore Americans to health. Whole wheat flour, you know, gave the teeth a workout. It led to a healthy colon, you know, a healthy, strong colon. So he had all these ideas about the health benefits of whole wheat. And so he wrote his book laying out in very careful detail how to make whole wheat flour, and he called the whole wheat flour Graham flour, and his Graham bread, and that eventually became what we know today as Graham crackers. You know, of course, his bread had no sugar or spices in it, and of course, Graham crackers today include those ingredients, and it's also a commercial product. So
Graham's countering of our animalistic desires that were getting the better of us gave rise to the Graham cracker, now a Nabisco-branded snack. You write that his lifestyle advice included some pretty sensible advice. What else besides Graham crackers did Sylvester Graham prescribe?
His lifestyle plan was pretty ascetic, you know, getting regular exercise and bathing regularly, getting fresh air and drinking fresh water, also wearing loose clothing. You know, he believed that tight-fitting clothing was bad for the body, going to bed at this very prescribed time, getting up early. I mean, it was all about the rituals of the day and making sure that people weren't straying too far from it. It was a very restrictive way of life. His popularity lasted a few years, really, in the sort of early to mid-1830s, before I think he became even too extreme for his Grahamites, as they called themselves, his followers.
You write also about one very notable Grahamite, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, a name familiar to all of us. What did he do with Graham's prescriptions?
Yeah, so Graham died in 1851, I believe. So fast forward about 40 years, and in Battle Creek, Michigan, it was a health spa, and it was run by Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, who was a Graham disciple, and he was always concocting these new food products, and he was kind of tooling around the kitchen one day and created this cereal. He served it to his patients, went over quite well. And he started marketing it, and eventually that became known as cornflakes.
Who would you likely compare Sylvester Graham to today? Would he be more food guru and author Michael Pollan, or the evangelical leader Pat Robertson?
Probably a combination of both. I mean, I would say that the thing that really separates Graham from somebody like Michael Pollan is he's a bit of an extremist. You know, I mean, he was all about this very regimented diet, and it certainly was linked to religion, but I would say less so than in evangelical ministers that we have today. You know, his diet was more along the lines of these kind of fad diets, you know, the paleo diet, South Beach diet, a baby food diet. Even Atkins, I would say, is more kind of similar to what he was promoting.
Adi Braun, thank you for opening up this really odd chapter of history for us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Adi Braun, she's written for NPR, for Lapham's Quarterly, and The Atlantic, where you can find her recent article on the 19th century food guru Sylvester Graham. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org.
Last night, restaurants were packed with couples in love. But for the parents of young children, getting out to a nice restaurant can require some tricky logistics. Between babysitters, winter colds, and sheer exhaustion, it's understandable when parents decide to ditch romantic efforts in lieu of pajamas and another night of bad TV. But why not try to have a date night from the comforts of home? Producer Taylor Quimby and his wife discovered a way to enjoy the best of both worlds. Maybe.
From the beginning?
Yeah, sure.
Dear Tiffany Nicole, super badass Raish, it is 90 degrees right now. Hot enough to make my head spin, and yet I would risk being hotter still if it meant I could hold you close, tangle my arms and legs into yours. My weird parfait of light and dark against your beautiful honey-scented milk chocolate skin. You were so much nicer to me. It's not fair that we should have to fight.
I wrote that letter in 2009. It was a couple years before my wife Tiffany and I had our son, Finn, and about 3 years before we were married. She was living in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I was living in Keene, about an hour away at the time. And frankly, there is no way I can compete with that guy. Partly because you don't usually write long love letters to someone who sleeps next to you every night. But in general, it does take twice as much effort nowadays to be half as romantic. And rediscovering chemistry seems to require looking outside the box. Except in this story. In this story, it actually does come in a box. Tiffany first read about Plated on her Facebook feed. The company-sponsored ad successfully preyed on her love of food porn. And with one click, she discovered their simple and yet baffling concept.
So you go online, you pick a recipe, they send it to you. That's basically it.
So it's like ordering takeout.
No. It's all the ingredients to make what you want to make, and then you make it. Like, by yourself.
So it's like ordering food from the grocery store and a recipe.
If you want to say it like that, yeah.
So I was skeptical. But that's no reason not to try something new. And even if it was a scam or we screwed up the food, at the very least, it might make for good radio.
Okay, first option is a skirt steak with cilantro chimichurri.
What's chimichurri?
Hold on, we'll get to that. And carrot citrus hash, which looks pretty good.
That sounds tasty.
Yeah. So that was the first one.
Yeah, vegetable this fried rice. That's pretty self-explanatory.
Cauliflower spinach empanadas with a spinach salad.
Arroz con pollo.
That looks really good.
That's just rice and chicken. Of course it looks good.
Yeah, but I'm just saying the picture.
Yeah, yeah. Really well, okay.
We decided on the skirt steak with cilantro chimichurri, whatever that is, and carrot citrus hash, but hit a snafu at checkout. Plated requires that you order a minimum of 4 meals per order.
Now it's $60 instead of $30.
Well, we get $20 off for your first time you use it, no matter
still
what.
$40 for, you know, dinner that you're going to make yourself is goofy.
So I should just preface this by saying I'm a notorious cheapskate, but paying the same amount for a meal I could eat at a restaurant when I'm going to do the cooking and the cleanup sounds like a bit of a con. I felt better about the whole thing a few days later when our Plated box showed up at the front door.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I told you it was in a...
Oh, hold on. I got it. Let me snap some pictures here. This is pretty. It's like an astronaut box. It's so silvery.
I know. So, everything's packaged nicely.
Each ingredient, from the handful of cilantro to the little teeny pinch of cayenne pepper, was individually packaged in a little plastic bag.
This one little clove of garlic comes in its own little package. Tiny thing of butter, so you must use that little thing of butter for something. I mean, this is pretty ballin'. I like this.
My inner environmentalist cringed at the amount of packaging required for this one meal. But you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs.
All right, so we're going to stick this back in the attic until tomorrow?
It's going to be really cold up there.
The next night is date night. And before I give you the rundown, let me explain what makes this concept so difficult. When you go out, you get ready, your babysitter arrives, and you ditch your pigsty of a home. For parents, the ideal date doesn't involve stepping on a plastic dinosaur on the way to the bathroom, finding a crayon in your shoe, or having to listen to Raffi during dinner. At home, there is a powerful gravitational force pulling you away from romance towards efficiency, convenience, and to putting your pajamas on around 7 p.m. So to make our Plated experience a true date, we couldn't be satisfied with good food alone. We had to go the extra mile for one another. The next night, I get home a little after 6 p.m. The living room looks like a toy store after a mild earthquake. Tiffany is wearing her pajamas.
Yay, birthday!
So I'm gonna jump in the shower.
Okay. See ya.
6:30. This is about the latest we usually eat dinner, but since we're not going to start cooking until after Finn's bedtime, I tied myself over with mixed nuts and a couple slices of salami.
Dada, need cashews.
These are mixed nuts.
Oh, mixed nuts.
Mm-hmm. Daddy's hungry.
Around 6:45, Tiffany notices that I'm dressed nice and says something about this being radio, not television. She hops in the shower while I clear the table of dried Play-Doh stains and empty the laundry baskets.
You get out of my laundry basket. Those clothes are clean.
7:15, story time.
Two little ladybugs basking in the sun. Along came...
7:45, lights out.
Love you.
Sit tight.
Good night, Bubba.
8 o'clock. Date night begins.
Okay, number one, prepare ingredients. Peel onion, cut into small dice.
Most nights after Finn goes to bed, there is a noticeable slump in energy level on our part. So it's not surprising that as we started to cook, it didn't feel like a date so much as a chore.
I'm using all of these carrots.
What's this? Well, the bag says it's 16 ounces, but the ingredients only call for 12 ounces, so maybe not all of them.
And there were the typical food fiascos that happen when you're cooking something new. Smoky kitchen, undercooked steak, that sort of thing.
Ooh.
But as the pieces came together and the table was set, our apartment did look, for the first time in a long time, like a nice place for a date.
Hey, so you know Joseph Gordon-Levitt has a new TV show?
Yes.
And then we sat down to eat. Chimichurri, by the way, really good.
The carrot hash is, like, way more intense than I thought it would be. I thought it was going to be kind of... bland. I don't know why.
Because of the citrus, you mean?
Yeah.
The orange lemon?
Yeah,
but it like goes so well because of the honey and the cayenne and the cilantro. That all plays in nicely together.
Mm. Cheers.
Cheers. Love you.
Love me too. Listen, baby. Ain't no mountain high. Ain't no valley low.
Ain't no river wide enough, baby. So, was it worth it? For couples looking for a one-time date night like me and Tiff, cost may be a bit prohibitive, all things considered. But the experience did remind me that the only thing that separates a date night from any other is the effort that you put into it. There was nothing stopping us from eating in front of the television, except how absurd it would have been to spend so much time and money on the meal, only to ignore each other. And that goes for just about everything when you're married, I think. You can half-watch TV while you scroll through your Facebook feed on your iPhone, or you can pop some popcorn, pick up a movie you both want to see, get rid of the distractions, most importantly, and make it a date. It's not a love letter, but it does say, I love you. Oh, baby, that ain't no mountain
high enough. Ain't no valley. That piece was produced by Word of Mouth's Taylor Quimby. You can see pictures of Taylor and Tiffany's special date night from Plated at wordofmouthradio.org.
My funny Valentine.
Thank you for joining us today. If you like what you heard, please pass it along to a friend or share it on social media. It's easy to do, just a couple clicks away at wordofmouthradio.org. And we're going to leave you today with a little post-Valentine's Day testament to the power of love. Last week, I spoke with Justice Sonia Sotomayor for Writers on a New England Stage. Along with her remarkable life story, she revealed some pretty interesting things.
I haven't given up hope I'll meet somebody. I understand it's a little intimidating.
Well, we think Justice Sotomayor would be a great catch, so we created a dating profile for her. Her interests include...
I go to the gym... I play poker. One of the Saturday morning things I've been doing is exploring D.C., Virginia, and Maryland by biking. I think that there's nothing more exciting in the world than to be curious about the world.
Although she does admit she can be a little judgy at times. You can check out Justice Sotomayor's dating profile at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you know anyone on the market, share it with a friend. After all, some great love matches have been ignited by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth will be back on Monday with a President's Day roundup of interviews from writers on a New England stage. And you can find us anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Each day is Valentine's.